coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. I hope everybody has been doing well. Just so you know, we will be doing an episode coming up soon about the whole JFK file dump, what that was all about, some of the information in it. We will be doing an episode coming up very soon about the Giza Pyramid revelation. Still plenty of data to come out, folks. Capital D data. All capitals on that data, because it needs to be peer-reviewed, everything else. So we'll be talking about that here in the upcoming weeks. Next week, we'll be excited to be bringing you our live coverage from Lone Star Paracon in Schertz, Texas. The Klinger brothers are putting on Lone Star Paracon again this year, and it's going to be a fantastic day. We will be out there doing live coverage, getting all kinds of interviews with great researchers. I know Mike Ricksecker is supposed to be there. I think Jason McLean's going to be there as well with the table. All kinds of stuff. King Gerhardt is speaking. Quite a few others. So stop on by, check that out, everybody. That is happening in Schertz, Texas. And I can bring it up on screen. Lone Star Paracon. Here. There we go. Due diligence done. There it is. Lone Star Paracon, everybody. It is a fantastic day. You can see all of the speakers that are lined up there. It's going to be an awesome day. Come on by, check it out. It's a fantastic, fantastic event. They always do a great job. So our guest in the second part tonight is our good friend and director of international investigations with MUFON, Bob Spearing. We will be talking about some of the cases of interest that he has called together for this year's symposium, along with some really strange jellyfish-like entities that are appearing in people's rooms throughout numerous sightings that have happened. So that's a fantastic interview. Stay tuned to that through the commercial break, everybody. Our guest in the first segment is the amazing Mary Joyce. She is the head over at SkyshipsOverCashiers.com. She has numerous books that are all available in the Curious Realm store, including the book that we are talking about tonight, Cherokee Little People Were Real. The legendary stories of the Cherokee Little People. Welcome back to the show, Mary Joyce. How are you doing this evening?
That's a lot of research. I was surprised to see you flash that up there just then.
Yeah, I'm pretty quick on the buttons.
Yeah, you're good. You're good. Not about it.
But, you know, this is a fantastic book, Mary, and really one of those stories. It's one that I think I don't know if you could really say steps foot into the realm of cryptozoology, but definitely, well, I guess it would, because some people would, I guess, call the little people brownies, things like that, and some nomenclatures.
Brownies are different than what I've done.
Okay.
Research.
Okay. Well, let's get into your research. And how did you first come to be aware of the legend of the Cherokee Little People, Mary?
I'm probably like most of your listeners. I'd never heard about them. And then I moved to the mountains of Western North Carolina. In fact, I'm about a 20-minute drive from the Cherokee Indian Reservation. And people who've lived here for a long time, they know about the little people. That is just part of the Cherokee culture. And when I first heard about it, I figured they were just like teaching stories, old, you know, just kind of mythical stories just to teach life lessons. And I kept hearing about it. And one day I got into a conversation with an elderly man who's lived in this area for many years. He'd been a pastor for about 40 years in one of the mountain churches. He was a World War II hero. And we got into this conversation about the little people. And he said, they're real. And he said, right after World War II, when he was a young man, he was helping with the construction at Western Carolina University, which is about 20 minutes from where I live. Again, I'm in the mountains. And he said every time they were digging into what was supposed to be virgin soil to construct buildings on that campus, they would run into these little tunnels that were cut into like dense red clay. And as a general rule, the tunnels were square cut with a rounded top, and the arch top makes the tunnel stronger. And they would run into these everywhere. And, you know, he was very believable. And so because of the connection with him, he connected me with other old-timers who had been involved with construction at WCU. And so one year I spent a lot of Saturday mornings around breakfast tables with these old-timers, just hearing their stories about what they had seen and observed and experienced. And I would never have been able to get those stories without this man opening the door for me, because you just don't go knock on the door of the white people or the Indians around here and immediately get a story out of them, even though you know they have one.
Well, and you know, that is something that we have talked about with numerous guests here recently, Mary, is the idea of how you broach questions like that whenever it comes to an investigation, especially whenever you're talking an indigenous culture. You know, if you are not speaking their nomenclature, the odds of you getting an actual story or account are pretty nil.
In fact, when I've had many, I'm old enough to have had many jobs, and I've worked for major corporations, Fortune 100 companies. I've had jobs that have been very demanding, required a lot of travel. And when I moved to the mountains, I wanted a job where when I was done with the job at the end of the day, it was my time so I could do some of the things I wanted to do.
Sure.
And so I became the manager of a health food store. I had no idea that that health food store would be the magic door to so many stories, including the ones about the little people. And over time, people began to know me and began to trust me. And so I was able to get those kind of stories because of that. Wow. And it wasn't just in the store. For example, there was a regular waitress at a restaurant I went to, and I became friends with the waitress. She knew what I was doing with the little people stories. One of the women who worked there was Cherokee, a young woman about 29 at the time. And it was because of the waitress talking to this woman and convincing her that I was okay to talk to, that I was able to get the stories. Again, I would not have gotten it without somebody there to open the door. So you don't just, you know, these are not easy stories to get.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, at what point did you start collecting these stories and really start considering putting them out as a book, Mary?
Oh, can I look and see what my copyright date on this is?
Because
I
don't. Absolutely. Let me see.
Wait, I've got the book here. Copyright 2014. But I had done the research before that, and the original version of it didn't have the photos and all the visuals in it, and I just gave them to the university and the local museums. The reason I did the book was because all of these people were old timers, and none of them are living now. But at the time they were, and I knew that when they died, all these stories and all their information would disappear with them because nobody had recorded it. And that was the motivation. I just couldn't see all of that information going down the drain, never to be seen again.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. I recently did an event at South by Southwest here in town with fire keepers. And the whole idea is how do you pass on traditions, period, indigenous traditions. How do you make sure that they stay alive? The example that I normally give on the show is I'm Cajun. I'm 50% Cajun. My mother understands a little bit, but you're hard pressed to find anybody in my family who's alive who is fluent in Cajun.
Did you grow up in the New Orleans area?
I did not. My family's from the Mamou area, very, very deep Cajun root, but It was
where
one of those
is that?
Things.
I'm not familiar with where is that? I'm not familiar
probably,
with the name.
Probably about 3 hours east of New Orleans. So
okay, still down in that area,
about an hour away from Baton Rouge, stuff like gotcha. That. But gotcha. It's one of those that because it was taught as the language of shame in school. There are pictures of, you know, the dunce kid sitting in the corner for speaking French in class, stuff like that. It was literally spanked and beaten out of a generation of Cajuns.
That this just like is what the happened to the Native Americans.
Exactly. This is the language of the ignorant. Eventually, the stories become the stories of the ignorant, you know, and you're encouraged not to share your culture anymore. And even some of the culture, there's a big resurgence in study of Rougerou, stuff like that, which is kind of the Cajun werewolf to an extent. But these stories very, very easily get lost in society. It does not take long for them to just disappear and vanish, Mary.
That's correct. That's correct.
Now,
and in fact, I mean, it's changing around here, but for the longest time, as I understand it, the natives would not even talk about the little people with white people just because they were laughed at, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that's just it. And I think that there is hopefully a different aspect to that now. There seems to be a large resurgence in these kind of stories, this kind of folklore, this kind of tradition, not only within the Native American communities, as was witnessed during that South By event. Where everything was about how do we continue our traditions? You know, how do we make sure that the world knows what these traditions are and how important they are? Now let's get into some of the actual Cherokee teachings and stories about the little people, Mary.
Let me stick in the beginning with the university where there must have been an absolute little city of these little people once upon a time. It's important to know that the Cherokee originated from the Great Lakes region, and in ancient times they migrated down to the Appalachian Mountains. When they first arrived, they kept seeing these little gardens, and they didn't see any people. And finally, they saw these little people coming out from beneath the ground to collect their vegetables from the garden by the light of the moon. So they were originally referred to as the moon people. Now, some people mistakenly think they were the moon-eyed people and kind of think like they're like ETs with the big eyes. That's not the case. It was because they came out at night when the moon was out. That was the original name they were given. And there was more than one. Well, let me stick with the campus. I interviewed all these old timers. One of them was a professor at the university, which is Western Carolina University. And he had a small skull sitting on his desk. He kind of used it like a decorative paperweight and a conversation starter. And he always told people it was a child's skull from, you know, an Indian mound. And one day, a high school teacher was in there and picked up the little skull and looked at it. And she said, "This is not a child's skull. It has all of its wisdom teeth." And the rest of that, one of the guys that I talked to, he dug this up originally, I think, with a bulldozer. And that's how some of these things were found. The rest of the skeleton, one of the people had it displayed on their mantle in their house. Now, I don't know what wife would permit this for that particular display place, but that's what had happened. So it just, you know, got very, very convincing that the little people were real. And again, these guys all witnessed these little tunnels being found all over the campus. One of the things I'm very, to this day, very critical about the university, one of the reasons I'm critical of the university is because they were more concerned about building new buildings than preserving some really unique archaeological evidence. And there was a man who contacted me, and he had been a student at Western, they call it Western, you know, as a college student. And he and some of his friends were you know, just hanging out by one of the creeks. We have creeks everywhere here. And the head of security came by and had a box that was a little bit bigger than a shoebox. And they got into a conversation, and the head of security told the boys that he had some of the bones of the little people bones that had been found when they were working on this building, and he was taking them to rebury them someplace else. So there was that kind of effort to keep the building projects going. And I think they made a big mistake. I think if they'd even preserved some of this information, some of the sites, it would have been a real building block for a major archaeological department at the university. They do have anthropology, but I think archaeology could have easily developed just based on this alone.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's just it. These things get cursorily scraped over so fast. You know, nowadays things are a little bit different. You run across a bone of any sort of human origin, like,
you have to stop.
Excavation stopped. Like, I don't care how important that building.
Rule, I think that was the rule, I think, at this time too, during some of this construction, and they just, you know, found ways to get around it, and that probably goes on everywhere. But, you know, some of the story, the more I got into it, you know, people would contact me, and there was one man, he actually got communicated with me through someone else who knew me. And he called it a lead head, and it was about an inch and a half in size, oval shape, and it had a face on each side of it that looked just like a leprechaun. And he had found it when there had been a major flood in this area. It was an absolutely major flood in 1940. And so much of this land had washed away. So deep down beneath the surface, he found this little thing. And he called it a lead head because it was so heavy. And you could see the seam that went around the edge of it. And so there was a leprechaun's face on each side of it. They're not exactly the same, but you could see how they had been somehow stuck back together. But it was absolutely ancient. And in my book, I do have a picture of that. And right next to it, I have an image of the leprechauns from Ireland. And you can see the similarities. Now, let me tie this together in another way.
Absolutely.
I was shocked when I found out from the Indians that they did not like one type of little people. I'm talking the Cherokee now.
Okay.
The grown-ups.
Sure.
And they would try to kill them. And the group that they didn't like were described as having red whiskers. And that's all I know for sure. But the Cherokee that we know today looked like the Native American Indians. So the ones that looked perhaps more like a leprechaun, they didn't like.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, once again, it's fascinating to see the parallels between that and almost fairy lore whenever it comes to things like leprechauns, brownies, and the different types. Because a lot of people do not realize that fairies are not just what you see in Walt Disney. They cover a panoply of beings, from mermaids to sirens to, you know, all kinds of things.
Maybe at this point I should make it real clear that these Cherokee little people that created all these tunnels, they look like miniature forms of regular Cherokee. Regular people.
And that's what I was just about to ask, though, is are there different types of little people within the Cherokee legend, specifically more than just the two that you've mentioned, the ones that look like the Indians, but also the ones that look like the Indians with the red hair? Are there more than just the two?
I've done a couple stories ages ago, so I couldn't really quote them very well.
Sure.
Where people have, you know, run into characters that would be more like gnomes.
Okay.
I've also had people say that they've seen fairies. I have not done a story on one of those. It's so hard to present information that makes it believable. You know, that's the kicker with all this. I've got a part of my background is newspapers.
Yeah.
And you just don't charge ahead, you know, half baked. And some of these things, you know, they make a great cursory story, but man, you got to back it up with stuff. And the ones about the fairies are a lot harder to back up.
Well, and you know, that brings up an important point that we bring up all the time. I mean, a lot of what this show is about, Mary, is demystifying thick and hard topics. You know, and trying to break those down.
I'm glad you're doing that.
Thank you. Thank you. Because it's one of those, it's very hard not to get swept up in the drama, the melodrama, the amazing, awesome story of Encounter, you know. But much like I've said about my paranormal encounters, should they be proven to be something else? Okay. That doesn't change what happened to me on that night. That doesn't change how I felt about it and how it changed the way I look at the universe and the world around me, just because my experience is proven to be something else. It doesn't subtract from the experience.
Right.
You know, so the idea that you are tempering these experiential stories that, yes, may be inordinately fanciful in a couple of dimensions, but tempering that with truth and fact, and what can we back up before we just go out and start putting this
start
out
talking.
There? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, precisely.
Let's be a little bit lighthearted here. I've gotten some cute stories from some of the Cherokee themselves.
Okay.
And this one young woman, the one that was connected to me through the waitress at the restaurant, and she was telling me about how her family had a small trailer up in an area called Big Cove, which is up in the higher mountains in Cherokee. And they used it as a place for a kitchen and stuff when they would have their family get-togethers. So it was a little trailer, as I understand it, with a kitchen and a bathroom and just the basics. And so this little, at the time, she was a little girl, and she and her friends were playing hide-and-seek. She decided she would go in and hide in the shower in the little trailer. She pulled back the corner, and there was a little guy, a little man, just grinning as big as could be. Even though they all know about little people, just the suddenness of it, you know, scared her, and she went running to her daddy. But that was one of the stories that kind of has stuck in my head. She also told me about an aunt and uncle that she has that live in an even more, well, let me back up. They live in Snowbird, which is a more remote area here in North Carolina, and there are more full-blooded Cherokee living there than there are on the Cherokee Indian Reservation, which gives you some idea of how we're really getting back to the way things really used to be. And her uncle was talking, she went down there to visit, and her uncle was talking about how the little people would visit on a regular basis, and she wasn't quite sure he was telling her the truth. Well, he went and took flour and spread it all over the front porch. They went to bed. When they got up in the morning, there were these little footprints on the front porch. And the old timers will still to this day put food out for the little people. And the kind of lighthearted part of this is if the people forget to put out the food for the little people, there will be pebbles thrown on the roof just as a reminder.
Interesting. And there once again is that fascinating mischievous nature that comes about in so many stories like that. Now,
Let me leave the state. I went out to a number of years ago, went out to South Dakota and was on the Indian reservation. I get very fortunate sometimes. Again, at a restaurant, I got into a conversation with a young woman, and her grandfather was a shaman with the tribe out there, which and her brother was also a shaman, and she was very intuitive, and she told me several stories, and one time they took her grandmother out to one of the creeks to fish, and they left her mother and grandmother in a chair with the fishing pole, and the rest of the kids went down the creek to play in the water. Her relatives, somehow or other, the boys, they went into a little cave that they found off the side of the creek, and they found a little bow and little arrows and a little quiver, and they took them back home, And the grandfather got really upset with them, said, "You take those back. You're not to mess with the little people." After that happened, the whole little community was bothered by a great deal of mischief. And I can't blame the little people. They can't fight the big people.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just want to be left alone, just like the Bigfoot. The Bigfoot want to be left alone. The little people want to be left alone. But that's what happened after the boys took their stuff.
And you know, that is so often the case with, quote, guardian spirits of the woods. Like you said, Sasquatch included, yes. Is the fact of do not. Yeah, and there are numerous warnings in tribal cultures about these things. Do not accept food from them. Do not follow their songs into the woods. Don't
we're still
follow
on little
them
people.
The woods.
We're on little people, not Bigfoot, right?
Both, kind of. You know, it's one of those we live adjunctly next to them, but we aren't really supposed to interact in that kind of way. You know,
they want to be left alone.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And if you don't, there will be consequences, you know. Once again, in the fairy stories, things like that, like it was very Hans Christian Andersen and Brothers Grimm with the fairies. Like things would go really bad. Like they would come steal your children in the night. Things like that.
I haven't heard any stories like that. So I'm fairly convinced that the Cherokee parents also use that to keep the kids from not going too far away.
Sure.
So whether there was total truth in them being taken, I'm still not sure.
Yeah.
Because it's a very effective way of getting children not to wander off too far.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And once again, those cautionary tales that get woven into society and passed down and passed along. That was very much the same way with the Rougerou and Cajun culture. It was like he crept around in the woods and in the swamps and in the cane fields, like the two places that there are for a Cajun kid to go get into trouble in the night. You know, that's pretty much the only place that in some communities that there is to go do is go out into the middle of the woods and drink beer, things like that. So it's like, hey, you know, kind of keeps people in line.
Whatever works.
Absolutely.
Also, I think I'm jumping around a little bit,
okay.
But I think you'll appreciate the irony to this. There is an old build. I know it's not like dilapidated. It's like one of the original buildings on the campus at Western Carolina University. And this could only happen in the mountains. They had a two-story building there and they wanted to expand. And you usually think about expanding either to the side or up. They cut in underneath the building and created a basement level beneath the original building. In the process of that building being built, there were three little people tunnels that were found going out from that point. And after they put reinforcement walls in there, you could no longer see the little tunnels. And I always found it ironic that on the inside of the room is where the anthropology department is. So this big, thick wall separates the anthropology department from these tunnels that still exist.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that kind of weird?
That is strange.
Yeah, I thought it was very strange.
Now you take reports of all kinds on your website, Skyships Over Cashers. Do you ever get reports of little people, even to this day, Mary?
I did. I got one. I'm supposed to talk, if it goes well, I'm supposed to talk to the guy on Friday. And I think he's out in Oklahoma, which would be another place where little people would be because the Cherokee and the Trail of Tears went out to Oklahoma. And he was all excited because he had actually seen one. So it'll be interesting to see if that turns into a story.
Wow, that is interesting. And once again, to hear these things move on into modern day, it's not really something I'm fascinated with it, Mary, because amongst all of the cryptozoology, all of the Native American legend and lore that is out there, Thunderbird, even, you know, stuff like that. This is not something that you hear a lot about in the communities of para research. You know, you hear a lot about giants in America. You know, you hear a lot about the giants of the Southwest and the Native American stories out there, the stories of the Paiute and burning them in a cave and them being hunted as meat, all kinds of things. But you don't hear that much about the little people. As far as this goes, as far as I know, I think there is a children's book about the Cherokee little people, and there is your book. That's pretty much it. As far as the topic of Cherokee little people goes, unless there is something out there that is more traditional or has a conglomeration of stories or encounters.
I haven't looked for quite a while, but there is a book, and it may be the one you're referring to, that was done by Lynn Losey, and she is a Native American, and she did a book with a lot of illustrations, and that may be the one you saw. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you what the name of the book was.
Hold on. I'm bringing it up on screen right now. The Little People in Southeast Native American Folklore is the name of it.
No, that's somebody else.
Huh.
I don't think that's it. Lynn Losey, is that the author? Yeah, there's the title. That's it. That's it.
Yeah. So, and, you know, once again, to have such an interesting topic and something that traces right back to Native American roots. I'm one that, especially with storytelling traditions like that, because these are encounters with these and stories like this and stories like Sasquatch, stories like giants are different than their creation myth. They're different than their stories of religion. Things like that. They are stories of community that live, once again, adjunctly with them.
Well, you know, we have Bigfoot living mostly unseen here in the mountains where I live. I've done a whole book on that too.
Yep.
If something that big can pretty much stay out of sight, imagine how much easier it is for a little person who's about, they're generally said to be about 3.5 feet tall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Much, much easier time to hide. And I got into a conversation recently, and I hadn't really thought about this completely, because I was asked why we have underground bases, Bigfoot, little people, all in this same area. And I've given different reasons before, but one of the reasons is because it's less populated. Another reason is there's a lot of caves in this area. So the little people live in caves. The Bigfoot live in caves. And I really do think that the military has expanded on existing caves to create some of their underground bases.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes the perfect entrance. It's already there. You don't have to go into the ground and build any kind of real infrastructure. You just reinforce what's there as you build through.
It's so much easier to start with a big space.
Yes, but precisely at that point, you just keep going down and it's a nice gentle incline. And all you do is support things as you move along. And just to get your point across there as far as amount of space, because so many people, whenever I discuss things like Bigfoot, even little people, stuff like that, like, oh, you know, we've been most of the places, like we've settled America. And I normally direct them directly to NASA to look up the United States at night so they can see exactly how much dark space there is. Like, that's where nobody is. Take a look at that. That is 2/3 of this country. 2/3 of the swath of the United States is totally unsettled. Doesn't have lights at night, things like that. Woods, backwoods, all that kind of stuff. And what's really interesting is when you overlay that, or even AB it next to like the Bigfoot Research Organization map of sightings, the sightings almost completely cover the dark spots.
Yeah, surprisingly, where you got it all lit up there, you know.
Yeah.
That includes where I live, and we have them.
Well, and once again, there is plenty of black in there. You know, you can zoom right in and see the fact that there is plenty of unsettled area amongst those cities there in the East Coast. So it's not that hard for animals to hide from us, you know, especially, there was a tribe that was just discovered no less than 3 years ago in the Amazon. that had never seen people. No, like, it was found because they were doing some forestry recon, getting ready to come and do forestry work, and had some drones. And the next thing they knew, the drone was getting attacked by arrows by a tribe that, well, had no idea what that thing was, but we're definitely shooting that out of the sky.
That's interesting. I knew that a new tribe had been discovered. I did not know the natives shot arrows at the drone. I did not know that part.
Yeah, it was classy. You watch the video and you can see them like throwing stuff at it and everything else. They have no idea what it is, you know, but it's definitely not a bird. but the fact is we run across this stuff all the time, you know. We run across civilizations and lost civilizations regularly. So we as humanity, once again, forget our history very, very rapidly. So even the fact that you have gathered all of these encounters and accounts together in one place, Mary, is fantastic because it. Have you contacted the Cherokee Studies Department there at the university?
That's where I took the first copy of it to you know, I took it out to the museum. Hopefully they still have it. I don't know. But they're kind of in a ticklish situation because the powers that be at the university don't want to play that up very much.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. And, you know, it really depends, I guess, on the university and what they, which that's strange to me, especially though with the Cherokee culture department there at the university, you know,
they're still part of the university.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there is a totally separate, I really don't know if there's still a totally separate Cherokee department or not. It's probably a division within another division of the university.
Yeah.
It would be my guess.
Yeah.
That's only a guess. I do not know.
And that is a sad fact, you know, all too often universities, things like that. And even this weekend in Houston, Rice University has the Archives of the Impossible. This is the second time that they are doing it. It's put on by the Religious Studies Department, and it is a group of ufologists that come and speak and present all kind of research. Jacques Vallée has given a large part of his private library to it. All kinds of people are. It is a huge archive of UFO data that is being created in the Religious Studies Department.
Repeat that again. I need to concentrate better.
Yeah.
Repeat that again. Where it is?
That is when. Archive of the Impossible at Rice University in Houston.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Really cool. I want to say this is the second time that they're doing it. The last one happened a couple years ago.
Anybody who lives near there ought to check it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I was close by, I certainly would.
But it's those kind of departments, religious studies, philosophy departments, things like that, that take interest in this because it ignites the thought form and the theory of thought in a different way, you know.
Also, when the universities get involved in some of this stuff, it becomes more okay, more legitimate.
Yep.
Another book that I did is called Tangible Evidence of Jesus Left Behind for Us to Find.
Yeah.
And I have one chapter that's based on the research of James Tabor, and I can't remember the other guy right now, how to pronounce it. And they did an archaeological dig where they found a tomb in the Holy Land, and it's the family tomb of Jesus. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but then when these guys with their credentials start digging into it, it becomes fascinating. Real briefly, during the time of Jesus, and it was a very short period of time, they had a very unique burial custom, and they would put bodies in a tomb for a year and seal them up until only the bones were left. Then they would put the bones in an ossuary or a stone box and put them inside a tomb that was dug into the hillside. And the most important person would be in the first niche when you walked into the tomb. And they found an ossuary. That's probably the ossuary of James, most likely, the brother of Jesus. And yes, that was in one of the niches in this family tomb. In the first niche, there was one, I don't know if I can pull this off from the top of my head, but it said something like, Jesus, the son of Joseph, was etched on one of them. A familiar form for the word Mary was carved on another ossuary in the same niche with the Jesus one. And then there was another one that said, Jude, son of Jesus. They were all in the same niche. It was in the first niche to the right of the entrance, which is the place of honor. The James ossuary that you just flashed on the screen was found in another niche. And also in another ossuary, it had a nickname on it. It was, I guess it's pronounced Jose, J-O-S-E. That was the nickname that Jesus gave his brother Joseph. And by tradition, you do not put familiar names like the familiar name of Mary or a nickname like Josie on an ossuary. You're yeah. supposed to put the proper names on it. But in this case, the rules were broken. So there's, and also the DNA in the Mary ossuary and the one in the Jesus ossuary are not genetically related. So it wasn't a mother or a sister. That makes it look like it truly might have been his family.
Wow. Wow. And you know,
that doesn't diminish anything from Jesus.
No, absolutely not.
His teachings have gone all around the world. And if you stick to the teachings and not to the churchy stuff, everything would be much better.
Stick to the big red words.
Yes. So anyhow.
I firmly concur with that. And it is one of those though that, as universities take interest in this, Avi Loeb is a prime example. You know, whenever he first took interest in Oumuamua as it passed through the solar system, that was really one of the first big perk ups where university got involved with this, got involved with UFO, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it really has kind of led a charge over the last 5-6 years of a windfall of university involvement. Once again, Rice University is right at an Ivy League school, you know, so
right. it's a top notch school.
Yeah. So to hear their Department of Religious Studies putting together shows like this, putting together archives, stuff like that, gathering these things together so that they are kept to be able to be analyzed by researchers in the future, stuff like that, to be able to have AI analyze archives, that kind of stuff, and find things that would take researchers years to cull right. through. You know, is fascinating. Now, you mentioned earlier the skull on the professor's desk. Have there been any other cases of bodies, bones, things like that being found in relation to the little people? Any DNA evidence?
I was told by somebody in the archaeology program at the anthropology department that they had two or three giant skeletons with six toes in their vault, so to speak. Then I heard several years later that all of those kind of things, including the little people skeleton, were sent off. I think it was the Smithsonian, but it was sent off somewhere. I don't know if we'll ever see it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I love and hate the Smithsonian.
Yes.
Because I have this. There, I know that there is a warehouse a la Indiana Jones at the Smithsonian where things are just being studied by top men, you know,
and just locked away.
I mean, you're never going to hear
about
it.
There was incredible finds in the 1800s.
Oh, absolutely.
And the people would have them, you know, somebody from the Smithsonian pick them up and take them, never to be seen again. You just didn't expect that to happen. You would think it would be a very credible institution that would, you know, make important things available. And it doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, and, you know, the prime example that most people give is the cave that was found in the Grand Canyon. Where
the one with all the Egyptian type stuff in it?
Yeah, the Egyptian and Babylonian and, you know, all kinds of ancient civilization. And the next thing you know, it's a national park, like the National Park Service has started and the Smithsonian is partially in charge of it. You're never hearing about anything. Oh, and you can no longer climb in the Grand Canyon.
At least not around there.
It was like, wow, that was quick
I don't
fashion.
Even understand why why they cover up history. I do not know. And some of the things that have been wiped off our website, skyshipsovercashier.com, let me see. All right. For example, since the ice has been melting so quickly in Antarctica, I've been, with the help of some other people, we've been finding things in Antarctica that, haven't been available for anybody to see for millions of years. We found the remnants of five ancient cities, and you can see the square shaped walls. And you can see how these walls are connected, and they kind of, they take an organic shape to them, like cities that form along a river or along a hillside, very organic looking, but these, you know, very square structures. I put that on the website, and within a day or two, it was all blurred out. All five cities, every time I post one, they get blurred out. So I have the same feeling that you have about the Smithsonian as I have for Google. Google Earth is wonderful for finding things, but they are quick to also cover up stuff that they don't, for some reason, want the world to know.
Yeah.
By the way, these ruins in Antarctica have to be the oldest in the world, because most scientists say it's been covered in ice for about 34 million years.
Yep.
Well, knock that in half. It still would be the oldest cities or the oldest remnants in the world. People think the Great Pyramid is old. Well, the Great Pyramid is generally believed to be about 5,000 years old. Even if it's twice that age, it is just a blip compared to 34 million years.
Well, and even the new research coming out of Giza right now with the SAR imaging, like I said at the beginning of the episode, we're getting ready to do an episode on that because it's one of those, we've got to talk about it. But we've also got to really wait for the data, capital D data, to be analyzed. We've got to wait for things to go through scientific method, make sure that
I did a really, really short story. It's on our homepage. It's at the top of it right now. It just got posted earlier today. The title is High-Tech Structures Revealed Beneath the Pyramid, Brief and Clear Description, which is a wonderful place to start. And I didn't post it until I did my own checking. And if you look at that second paragraph, I checked out, what was it? I checked out Cornell University, ResearchGate, Semantic Scholar, and several peer-reviewed scientific articles before I posted this to make sure that what this lady was telling us was important. And the reason I wanted to post this is the average person is not going to take the time to dive through all the research. But even what she has presented, it's in a bite-sized form that anybody can take the time to listen to. And it's a good starting point. Yeah. And it's only like 4.5 minutes long. And she does a good job. She happens to be a British actress.
Well,
which, you know, and who's interested in many things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those, I am not adverse to the thinking that this is the real deal. But we'll see.
But my point was that there has already been a lot of research.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it hasn't been done.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
You know, there's stuff you can dive into that you can figure out how to present it to people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I look forward to diving into that more. And a lot of these topics, though, Mary, they come with a dash of two things. One of them is the want of confirmation. The other is the cognitive dissonance, you know, when presented data to the otherwise.
I present my off the top of my head theory on these, what they have found?
Please.
I'll do it very concisely.
Go ahead.
I think that those look, what they're finding beneath the pyramid, I think it's electrically based. There are many, many sources for a long, long time that have talked about the pyramids being a power source.
Yep.
And the kind of things that are underneath it with those cylinders and all that kind of thing, it just looks like it might be structured for the powering up of that pyramid. That's the one point. The second point is there's no Egyptian that was living at that time who would have done that. So now we're back to ETs. And I think that they were the ones that actually constructed it. And the more we find out how complicated and complex these pyramids really are,
Yeah.
I think we really have to step back, because I don't know any time in human history when humans have been able to do something like that.
Well, and I'm trying to remember, I don't think Zahi Hawass has made an official announcement yet.
He has been the one who has always said the Egyptians did everything.
Yeah.
I have always disagreed with him.
He's
very belligerent about his point of
view. He is. And me and Stephen Myers, talk pretty regularly online, offline, on the show, all kinds of things. And, you know, we kind of jokingly refer to Egyptology as the cult of Egyptology. Because there are so many things like it. Can you please just stop pushing the paradigm that it's a tomb? Because it's not.
Right.
You say on one hand that you have to hide the sacred writings from the Book of the Dead on the wall for the soul to read as it exits the body, in order for it to have its heart weighed by Thoth and whether or not it goes to the afterlife or whether it gets thrown to a crocodile, right? There's not a single one of those in there. So I guess they just wanted this dude to just go into eternity, just be suffering right here on Earth in his own body, never being able to leave, you know, no Ushabti jars, nothing like that. No, in either the queen's tomb or the king's tomb, none of that. So it's strange, you know, if it's a tomb, and it's still to this day, if it, from people that I know who have gone and taken tours, like that is what they say. This is a tomb. Mm-hmm. It's a, so, if we could just get past that,
it would be a major thing, right?
It would be a huge thing. It would be a huge
but
thing.
But I saw him once, because briefly, I think there was a regular series that he briefly did.
Yes.
On our TV programs. I don't know if it was a series or if I just,
I think it was Uncovering Mummies or something like that.
It was so long ago. I couldn't tell you. The things that stick out are one of the people working for him presented something that was not quite the way he thought it ought to be. Man, he was rude. He just tore that person to pieces. So between being belligerent in his beliefs and belligerent in the way he treats other people, he is very low on my
chasing mummies.
He's very low.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know,
that's how it. Show that picture again, because that's how he feels about himself.
Not going to lie, I would gladly interview Zahi Hawass, but I would have some hard questions.
And if you do that, would you please let me know?
Oh, absolutely. Because once again,
I would love to see you take him on.
And just logical things like that that tend to just get glazed over. I'd like to talk about a little bit more. Because I am a believer of we are ingenious. We are an ingenious people, and we have reinvented ourselves numerous times over the eons, Mary, most definitely. So the fact that I wouldn't put it past the fact that we could have built it.
Mm.
You know, I wouldn't put it past that there were people like Ptolemy, all kinds of stuff, Archimedes. Even the things that Archimedes made were not repeated until the 1900s, 1800s almost. You know, so even looking at that, looking at the work of Da Vinci and the fact of 500 years later, we have a few of his inventions and use them regularly. You know, gliders, planes, helicopters, all
kinds of
things.
It's like he had a peek into the future.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, there are those ingenious people that can literally go professor from Gilligan's Island and electroplate something with a couple of coconuts and a little bit of copper wire. You know, like we know that the Egyptians electroplated items with gold. So they had power at least with the Baghdad battery, with a few of those put together of like 9 volts worth of power. You know, that's more than enough to operate a LED diode. To brightness, the little light that I have right here shining on my face is 5 volts. So that's all of 3 AA batteries. That's 3 Baghdad batteries put together to be able to generate this much light. You know, and there are organic compounds and chemical compounds that you can use to electroplate. And they knew all this stuff. It was fascinating. They had high technology, most definitely. So I am fascinated.
Maybe they were helped by ETs too.
Could have been.
Because we have E.T.'s, artwork in old caves going back, back to the caveman in multiple continents.
Absolutely. So, and numerous tribes like the Aborigines, the Dogons, numerous tribes that say that they come from the Anasazi, that they come from the stars.
Right.
That is their home. They came here.
The Cherokee here believe that they came from the Pleiades.
Yes.
And they originally hid the stories in what they call the stories of the seven sisters. It's the seven stars of the Pleiades.
Yeah.
And I just always thought that was kind of an interesting tidbit when I learned it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, those things are carried across generations. Those stories are carried across culture. And beyond cultures, because even the Japanese, the Subaru actually means Pleiades. If you look at their insignia, you can see the stars.
Uh-huh.
But same thing there. It had religious significance in their culture. So,
right.
These are not uncommon themes across humanity. Mary, we have about 4 minutes left. I want to thank you so much for coming on. Especially with such short notice, I'm glad that you were available. We need to have you on again and again. It's always a fun conversation. Where can people go to follow Skyships Over Cachers? Because I'm subscribed. I get all the emails, everything else. You put things out very regularly, very regularly. I am always glad
usually,
to see people.
If you
to
just
put
go
out
to skyshipsovercachers.com, we try to have something. We got it up early this week, but we try to have something up by Friday evening each week. This week we did it earlier simply because of that pyramid story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we posted three news stories early in the week.
Yeah. And once again, tons of articles that come out, just tons and tons, tons of topics. You also have an experiencer form where people can file a report as well. Where can they go to do that?
If you go there at the top of the page there, the very first listing, it just says contact. And if you open up that, it tells you how to get in touch with us, how to report a sighting and the actual contact information.
What is the most common report that you get on your website, Mary?
Well, for a long time, it was UFOs. But I'm not going to keep printing the same kind of pictures of UFOs, lights in the sky blipping by. That's boring. We've done a lot of that. And so now I try to get into UFO stories that are more unique. And one of the things that really kind of surprised me was we got pictures. I didn't do it, but somebody who lives in Cashiers did it. And they got pictures of a UFO hovering, fairly close to the ground. And it looked like an old rock, which makes me think of the what's the one you were just talking about? The long, skinny one?
Oumuamua.
Yeah, thank you. And I think they can disguise themselves when they want to.
Well, there is definitely that morphing technology out there, even amongst some of our own drones that are out there in the military sector. They can change form in air. They can move from one type of modality to another, move almost seamlessly from water to air. It's pretty fascinating where drone technology has gotten now. You do kind of have to ask yourself, have we reversed engineered something with all the whistleblowers, everything else coming out right now? I keep saying I don't think we're going to see a Houdini moment where it's like somebody's going to pull a sheet off a gurney.
Keep thinking the government's going to make a major revelation. They're misled because the government will only reveal what it's forced to reveal. And the revelations are coming through your show, through my website, through a whole bunch of us around the world are helping the exposure happen.
They'll only reveal what they are forced to reveal, like you said. B, they'll only reveal what is monetarily beneficial to reveal. Because, yes, eventually some of this technology, the only way you're going to make the money back from investment and back engineering it is to release it. So we That's where we see some of the new battery technologies. That's where we see some of the new drone technologies, things like that. So
maybe even aluminum foil.
Yeah, microwaves, things like that. You know, right. Lasers, CD players, storing data on crystals. You know, that kind of stuff, which is an actual thing. So that's where all this comes from, Mary. So thank you so much for your time tonight. Before we let you go, one last time, let everybody know what your website is and where they can go to get your books, Mary.
Skyshipsovercashiers.com. Cashiers is spelled like a cashier at the grocery store, but it's actually a town here in the mountains. And also, I got hacked on my Facebook page, my original one. I had about 5,000 people on it, severely hacked. So I've had to start a new Facebook page. And so people can follow me on Facebook. It's simply Mary Joyce. The old account had my middle initial in it, but it's just now Mary Joyce. And if you find more than one Mary Joyce, you probably will. I have an orange vest on. And so maybe that'll help people find it. So a lot of people like to find things on Facebook, and that's the way you can do it.
Absolutely.
And how you find the books, again, under Editor's Corner. If you click on that, at the very top, you can then click on books, right, stop right there, and then information about my books. If you click on that, it'll get you right to my books. And they're all available through Amazon, except for the last one, and it's explained there.
Absolutely. And Mary, once again, always a great conversation. Thank you so much for the time tonight. We're going to go ahead and let you go, but... we'll be sharing links, everything else, within the next day or so for the episode.
Thank you so much
for the conversation tonight. You take care of yourself.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Always a great time talking with Mary Joyce. She is such a learned investigator. And once again, the years of being a reporter just really, really make a big difference when it comes to research and culling through data. And as she was saying, making sure that what you're putting out is quality research, you know, not just hyperbole. We need to be careful with that, because much like she is with her website, Skyships Over Cashiers, I am with Curious Realm. It's the fact of we have an onus upon us to make sure that what we are putting out is quality data, not misleading data. That doesn't muddy or murky the waters as we swim in it, folks. So when we come back from this quick break, we will be joined by our good friend Bob Spearing. He is the Director of International Investigations with MUFON. We will be talking about MUFON cases of interest for the year, including jellyfish-like entities that are coming into people's homes and taking their energy right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store. To reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying tuned through that. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my source for amazing CBD products. I found them probably about 5 years ago after my doctor recommended CBD as a supplemental for my travel anxiety, and their product is absolutely amazing. A spigyric process is used where every part of the plant is used, reused, combusted, reused again, and the process repeated until nothing remains. Every part of the plant, from seeds to stems to roots to buds, leaves, everything is used to create an amazing full-spectrum CBD product. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com. Use the code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free CBD edibles on your way out the door as well. Our guest in this segment is the Director of International Investigations for MUFON, the amazing Bob Spearing. We will be talking about current cases that are ongoing internationally, as well as the amazing Project Aquarius archive from MUFON. Welcome back to the show, Bob Spearing. How have you been doing, my friend?
I'm doing good. How have you been?
Been doing okay, man. And actually, it was last time we spoke was right as you got a whole bunch of stuff for Project Aquarius from the Hayden Hughes archive. So it is great to hear that Project Aquarius is growing and growing and growing. These are the things that I am all about. The idea of digitizing these archives so that they're accessible to people and accessible to researchers to be able to get more data on the topic, especially historic data, which is some of what we're going to go through tonight, especially with ongoing cases. So how did you come to become the International Director of Investigations for MUFON, Bob?
Back in the day, I was a New Jersey field investigator, 2017 at the time, and MUFON created what was called the Special Assignments Team. It was sort of like the X-Files of UFO reports, and it was run by the Director of Investigations, Chase Klutsky, at the time. And when she retired from MUFON, she asked me if I would take over as being head of the SAT team, and we had some very, very good cases. And so I did that for a while, and that came to the notice of Ken St. John, our COO, and Dave McDonald, our executive director, and they asked me if I wanted to replace the retiring Steve Hudgens as director of international investigations, which I did, and that's pretty much how I got to where I am the past 5 years.
Wow. Wow. And an incredible path of growth that you have really laid forward, especially with things like Project Aquarius, stuff like that, Bob. Let's start getting into the investigations that you are in right now, because some of them sound absolutely fascinating.
Right now, I'm putting together MUFON's cases of interest from 2024. To present at the MUFON Symposium. And the criteria for these cases are, it either had to happen in 2024, or it could be of an historical nature, but okay, Reported in 2024, or part of a larger flap that includes a case of interest from 2024. And some of the things we're coming up with this year are quite bizarre. Some of them are funny. One, we actually have two videos from England in a short period of time where people were seeing these bright blue, neon blue objects in the skies. And initially we thought it was like the Goodyear blimp, because on the side of the Goodyear blimp, it's got that LED screen. And from far away, it can look like a massive blue object. The only thing is that those screens aren't allowed in England. So we had to rule out whatever it was, that it wasn't a blimp. But the one video of these two girls chasing the object in their car, and it is just a profanity laced but hilarious video as they're trying to chase this blue object. I'm debating whether to bleep out half the dialogue when I present it at the symposium, but it's very, very, very funny. I don't know if you're familiar with the Sandown Clown case from 1974 in the UK. It's a very, very, very high strangeness case where these two little children in a field come across a clown-like figure about 7 feet tall, almost like a scarecrow, and he's got a microphone, and he's screeching into the microphone, and when he sees these two little children, he tells them, hello, Sam, and the little boy says, my name's not Sam, all right? But he has a, yes, the Sandown Clown, he has a little hut right next to him, and he invites the children in. Initially, they're scared of him, and they ask him if he's a ghost, and he says, well, no, in a certain way I am, but in a certain way I'm not, which has led me to believe that he's either interdimensional or some sort of, you know, hologram or whatever. He seems timid. He tells the children he's afraid of people. And they go into his hut and they see little furniture and there's two levels. And they go back and tell their parents, and the entity is gone at this point. It's probably one of the most high strangeness cases you could ever imagine with an entity. It turns out that he comes back in Pennsylvania in 1996.
Really?
Essentially the same setup, only this time he doesn't have a hut. It's one little child. It's in a field again, same setup, some sort of portal to another dimension, a hut in the first case, a doorway in the middle of an open field in this wow. second case, a young child again. The child can see into the doorway in this field and essentially sees the same thing that the children saw in Sandown in 1974. This case took place in 1996. They can see a green room like the first children saw. They can see wooden furniture inside. And he again addresses of the little boy. And he tells the little boy, hi, Sam. And the little boy this time says, my name's not Sam, it's Luke. Oh. And the person didn't think about ever reporting this until they accidentally came across the Sandown Clown case, which was originally published in the before a British UFO Association magazine back in the late 70s, early 80s.
That
but
is
the
a,
thing that
go ahead. Well, no, go thing, ahead. Go ahead.
The thing that's really bizarre is that this year we got a third case in the MUFON database. A case came in from 1 year after the Sandown Clown case. Sandown Clown was 73. This case was from 74. This case was from Nova Scotia. And again, two children in a field come across a what they called the Rainbow Man. And he's sitting in lotus position playing the guitar. He's very tall, like in the other two cases. And instead of a hut, instead of a doorway, this time he invites the children to come into a tree with them. And they go into the tree and they can feel every molecule of the tree. They learn everything about the tree. They understand every leaf in the tree. They can hear each other's thoughts at the same time they can hear the entity's thoughts. And this time he tells this little girl who's with her brother something very sad. He starts telling her about her life so far. And he starts telling her about her future and how she's going to lose her brother, which she eventually does.
Oh, wow.
And so not only do we have some sort of interdimensional, colorful personality that uses some sort of portal to take children places, but he also seems to be aware of the past and the future. And for me, this triad of cases is probably the strangest grouping I've ever seen. I've been into UFO since 1965. This entity case or series of cases are the weirdest I've ever come across. And when you have three almost identical situations in a field with children, with a clown-type entity, with a portal of some sort over 30 years, that's enough circumstantial evidence to make the person believe that this is a pattern and that this is a real phenomenon going on with children.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, especially when you're we talk regularly on the show, Bob. And one of the things that I say, whether it's UFOs and the idea of CE5, or whether it's paranormal or even Bigfoot, I believe that these phenomena exist, but that there is also something else out there, be it interdimensional, what have you, that will gladly use the trope in our minds to put us at ease with its appearance, you know. And this I think is a very interesting case of where that may very well be the case, you know, that it's appearing as this, once again, clown-like figure that would be disarming to children. I mean, I don't know. That in and of itself is pretty frightening to me. If that appeared and then a portal next to it appeared and you could see into that. The portal, I think, is a very key part of this. The idea that all of the witnesses had some sort of portal appearance and the invitation to go through the portal, you know.
And they were returned safely.
Did some of them go through the portal?
Sure. In the Sandown Clan case, they go into the hut. They only looked into the doorway in the 96 case.
Okay.
And they do go into the tree in the 74 case.
And aside from the furniture, things like that, what else did they see while they were there? What else did they experience?
They didn't understand the message that the clown was trying to tell them, maybe because they were too young.
Sure.
But the thing is, the more and more I get into it, right now I've been researching bedroom intrusions, and a lot of things and entities come through portals.
Yes.
And we have another case that I'll be presenting where a man was in his living room, and he could only describe it as he was looking into his other room, and it felt like someone was pulling a cloth away. And he actually could see behind the cloth, and what he saw wasn't the next room in his house. He saw a control center with a balcony with men working machines.
Oh, wow.
And there were two levels, and he's basically looking at a control room in his house, and all of a sudden they look at him and it closes up. So I actually had an experience like that back in the 80s where I was looking at something and sort of a veil was pulled away. And while I was still looking at the same scene, I had a sense of enlightenment. And as soon as I realized that I was looking beyond the veil, it was gone. And I never had an experience like that again. But when I read this man's case, I said, it's almost identical to what I experienced. He, for one brief instant, had a veil pulled away. Why he was allowed to look into this portal, I don't know. But what he saw is essentially frightening. If reality is being controlled from a control room, are we living in a simulation? That's where that story's going.
Sure, sure. And you know, that is a hypothesis that has been put forth more and more in this day and age. The idea that, you know, we're basically living in agreed upon illusion. And you know, when you start getting into quantum physics, quantum mechanics, you know, it's not that far off, Bob. And even that is an interesting concept to entreat whenever you start considering the idea of UFO UAP phenomena. That idea that if we're living in an illusion, then are what we seeing is an illusion, or is it something that we are actively manifesting? And that, once again, goes back to CE5 protocols, goes back to the idea of what Barber, the last UFO whistleblower that came out, said. The psionic control of craft, the psionic summoning of craft, and the psionic connection of experiencer and craft.
Not only craft, but a lot of the experiencers reports that we get from MUFON are with entities,
sure.
entities and craft. With the clown, the Sandown clown, you're getting into Jacques Vallée territory where, you know, there is possibly this non-human intelligence that has been with us for all of human history and manifests itself in ways that we can understand. 500 years ago, a little gray in the bedroom might be considered a succubus or an incubus.
Yeah.
And today, or a troll or a dwarf or an elf. And today they're little grays. And it's just, yep. you know, the level of technology in that society interprets it the way that it's meant to be interpreted by whoever this agent is that, you know, might be living alongside us or coming through
yeah.
an interdimensional portal or as part of the simulation meant to interact with us at a certain
yeah.
level.
Well, absolutely. You know, and that brings up a huge point that we once again speak about regularly, that idea of nomenclature through the ages and even across cultural boundaries. You know, science takes very, very careful care to make sure that in different disciplines, scientists across the globe are using the same nomenclature, that the definitions that they're using cross-compat and mean the same thing in Japanese as English, because otherwise you could get into messy situations and misunderstandings very, very quick. You know, so
I think we do get messy interpretations.
We do. It's very much a game of telephone at that point, especially whenever it's played across time. Bob, and when you're looking at things, whether it's UFOs, Bigfoot, what have you, there are some similarities, especially here with this Sandown clown case, because many were the stories of fairies and people of the fae, things like that, where the warning was, do not follow them. Do not follow their voice into the woods. Don't follow their songs. If they give you food, don't take it because you won't
yes.
come back.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
Things like that. So the fact that fairies, things like that, were as close an analog as our ancestors could get to an interdimensional being or understanding the concept of a dimension, period. You know, for them, it's just the fairy world. For us, it's the next dimension or a parallel dimension or mm-hmm. even future or past people coming. So the idea of those things being the same is not strange.
Mm-hmm. And I remember there's a lot of stories about don't eat the food where
yeah.
people eat the food and then they never come back, or they come back and it's 100 years later and
yep.
you know, they're meeting their granddaughter. And what's very interesting parallel to that is that in a lot of, if you ever read the books, series of books, Humanoid Encounters, The Others Among Us by Albert Rosales, he chronicles humanoid reports over centuries. And more often than not, all of these invitations to go onto the craft, all of these, contactees and abductees claim that they're given something to eat. It's a parallel to these stories from 500
yeah.
years ago. All right. Even the fellow in the 50s with the pancakes, Nelson, do you remember he
yep.
came across the flying saucer, the land of flying saucer, and they're making breakfast and they give him some pancakes, wheat pancakes. So.
And I'm trying to remember the show, that it is now where, the gentleman offers the guy a piece of gum.
It was a science fiction show?
And it was more a psychological test.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of if you take the piece of gum, you're willing to do other things.
Ah, that's interesting.
You know, so it's more of a test of willing. And it was like whenever you're being interrogated, basically.
Right.
And it's like, oh, would you like a piece of gum?
Right.
But it's something so small and subtle that reveals so much about the person that you are coming in contact with.
And I do believe that they experiment with this. You made me think about screens. How many people are brought on board a UFO and they're sat in a chair in front of a huge screen and they're shown
yeah.
scenes of destruction of the earth and cities being flooded. And you would say to yourself, why would these visitors, whoever they are, wherever they're from, want to do that to somebody? All right.
Mm.
Except to elicit some sort of reaction, possibly emotional. You know, we're like, as Charles Schwartz said, we may be somebody's property. And
yeah.
we're just looking at us like lab rats.
That is something that we talk about with Earl Grey regularly, is even the idea of consent when it comes to abduction, Bob, and the idea of like, do you have to give your consent? You know, like a lion doesn't give its consent to get blow darted and chipped.
Right.
So, what's interesting? So we don't consider that an invasion on them because we're trying to help. So do the aliens consider it an invasion to come take us from our bedroom and chip us or implant us or track us? You know,
well, I definitely believe there's more than one team out there, and sure, some of them are good and some of them are bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you get I have plenty of reports of these bedroom intrusions where the person fought off the abduction. They said, yep, no, I don't want you to touch me, or they call out the name of Jesus or yep, something, and boom, it ends. And one person even said to the effect that I felt like they weren't allowed to touch me if I didn't give them my permission.
Yeah.
But then I think that there's other ones, they just lift you out of bed, slap you on that metal table, and start sticking needles in you, you know, in your belly.
And once again, that may, those two instances, Bob, may very well root right back to the beginning of our conversation, of one being the actual phenomenon, the other being something that is standing in its stead, because that's what mentally you would accept, you know? So it may be the fact that the ones that when you revoke your agency and they disappear, things like that, are the imposters, you know? But it's fascinating to explore these things, because once again, the idea of somebody being given messages, is a very, very common theme with abductees, very common theme. Like you said, the idea of being shown a movie screen, basically, and a mental projection coming to you of intent. How many cases a year like that do you guys see at MUFON, Bob?
A lot. I'd say last year I did a study. Approximately 17 to 20% of all cases that MUFON gets every year are some sort of abduction or bedroom intrusion where the experience or resource team at MUFON is involved. So that's a large percentage, 20%, for an organization that's really a nuts and bolts UFO landed in my backyard type operation. But, you know, we don't get that many, but when you were talking about Bigfoot before, I definitely see a correlation between Bigfoot and UFOs.
Really?
Often Bigfoot is seen in conjunction with the UFO, and a lot of those Bigfoot sightings in conjunction with that UFO, it's a very specific type of Bigfoot where they have glowing red eyes and have the ability to just disappear instantaneously in front of the witness.
Interesting. Now,
I'm a patterns guy all the way. I'm always looking for patterns.
Same here, because that is what data comes to reveal eventually. Mm. That's where you find the actual trails of nuts to follow, to find caches of nuts. And it's... that's really interesting to me, Bob, the especially the tie between Bigfoot cryptids and UFO UAP activity. Have you seen an uptick in these in the last, like, were Bigfoot and UFOs synonymous in that kind of way? Did MUFON take in a lot of reports like that, let's say in 1972 as opposed to 2025?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know, but the MUFON, the CMS system, the case management system, you can search by keywords. And I would be curious to see if I did a keyword search for Bigfoot, how many times it comes up and whether or not there are larger patterns or geographic locations where a lot of those reports come from. As a matter of fact, going back to Project Aquarius, that's exactly what we did with witness drawings. We have about 14,000 witness drawings, or about 10% of 10% of our 140,000 cases have witness drawings. And I prefer drawings sometimes over a very fuzzy nighttime photograph of an out of focus orb. And what we discovered is that people are drawing the same thing over and over and over again. We will get people that draw chevrons, which are the V-shaped objects, and they usually have like eight very large lights on the bottom of them. Sometimes the chevron is shorter on one side than another. And I'm not talking one or two drawings. I'm talking about dozens of drawings where these people are drawing lopsided chevrons. All right. They're drawing the triangles, the classic triangle with the white lights at each point, the red beacon light in the center bottom, over and over and over again. People drawing snakes in the sky. And what we realized, besides the fact people are drawing the same thing over and over and over, to get back to your original question, we found that there's patterns in when one site, one type of craft becomes predominant and then fades away, only to be replaced by, say, the triangles go away and the cylinders show up. And then the cylinders go away and the triangles come back. And we see this all throughout the 140,000 cases over a period of time.
Wow. Wow. And you know, I guess it was it last year that they had the shapes presentation that went through all the different shapes of crafts that have been reported? And even the idea of barbell craft, things like that, you know, being reported.
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's one of the new shapes they're going to be adding to the CMS, because we just had a plethora of dumbbell cases, and they even have a pattern. These dumbbells are massive, and they've actually been seen as far back as 1965. Some of them are dumbbells, and some of them we call keyholes, where it's almost like you have the one ball of the dumbbell and the rod coming out behind it, but not the second ball. Okay. And we classify those together as similar types of objects, but in all cases, they're massive. Many of them have what looks like hundreds of windows or decks in them. And most peculiarly of all, they're almost always sited in the northern forests of Canada, where you could hide a very, very large football field sized object.
Interesting. Interesting. And, you know, once again, just the fact that these shapes seem to have patterns to them as well, and patterns of their surgence and resurgence. Mm-hmm. I don't recall any real news articles about dumbbell-shaped UFOs. Of course, I mean, the winged UFOs, the triangles, things like that have been making news for a long time, you know, even beyond the Phoenix lights, things like that. But how frequently do you guys see that, you know, social media, things like that, I guess, cause a flap of its own with how things appear, with how witness statements come in, Bob?
The perfect example of that would be the New Jersey drones back in November and December. We had a 20% uptick in drone sightings in like 2 months. I think Newfork, had even higher. And a lot of it's the hysteria. When Sputnik 1 was launched, there was no hysteria. But when Sputnik 2 was launched with Lackey the dog, that was the beginning of the very famous November 1957 flap, where all over the country, especially in the Southwest Levelland, Texas, the Gulf of Mexico, military, naval sightings, this all happened in 1 week. And interestingly enough, there were two attempted dog nappings that week, one in New Jersey, one in California, where these little gray types said to one person, we're a peaceful people. We only want your dog. And of course, they were run off by a guy with a shotgun in one of the cases. But yeah, a lot of what we got with the drones was hysteria. But then what was interesting about that is that group of sightings broke apart into two separate groups, and the second group became people were seeing orbs. Okay, not only drones but orbs.
Yeah,
and they were saying, "Oh, well, we're doing military exercises." But Picatinny Arsenal said, "We didn't give anybody permission to fly anything over Picatinny Arsenal. We don't know what they are." Picatinny Arsenal, by the way, may actually have craft intact UFOs down in their basement. By the way,
yeah.
So what are the auras? And one of the things that people are getting into is we experiencing what's called mimicry? Are these really drones or are they something else? But they manifest just like we were talking about earlier with trolls and dwarves and little grays today.
Sure.
Are they trying to look like something that we would identify with? All right.
Yeah.
A very good case several years ago when the Chinese balloon got shot down, we were investigating octagons.
Yep.
And we got one report from near Offutt Air Force Base in Kansas where a guy was watching jets go by. And following these jets, he was seeing blue orbs following the jets. And he saw this three times. And the third jet that went by while he's watching these blue orbs following it, the third one right in front of his eyes turned into an octagon. Craft. So it went from an amorphous shape into a technological craft right in front of the guy's eyes. So what's the reality? Is the reality that it's an orb mimicking a craft, or is it a craft that has the ability to turn into an orb?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know that. It's interesting when those phenomena start crossing over like that, mm-hmm. Bob. It's much like I've said about Bigfoot and UFOs or Bigfoot and portals, things like that. Is once you have that situation, which side do you start investigating from? Do you start investigating from the Bigfoot sighting or from the sighting of the portal?
Right.
You know,
right.
Because you've got two vastly different, you know, what may be vastly different phenomena. They may be integrally connected, but at the same time, with two phenomena, you've got two different methodologies to start looking at and to start considering as far as investigative work goes.
Which shows why in 8 years we've barely, you know, touched the top of the iceberg as to what's actually going on. It's fascinating. That's why, yeah. I always hope with AI, some of the stuff you're doing, we're eventually going to be able to crunch everything,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and get really, well, it's not going to take me 3 months to find a pattern. It's going to take the AI 3 seconds,
you know, absolutely,
to find 10 times more patterns than I could find in 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we talk pretty regularly with, Ryan Edwards. He's a cryptozoologist right down the road, young guy, but brilliant mind. And one of the things that he brings up regularly is the timeline to discovery, Bob. The idea of when science gets interested in something, there's a gap between when we get interested and when we find it. And the example he gives is the lowland gorilla. Natives knew that the lowland gorilla existed. They'd talked about it for generations. Mm-hmm. Scientists got there and they're like, we see no evidence of this. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? It took them 30 something years, or more than that, almost 80 years from the time of natives telling them and them finally getting interested enough to start investigating it. Took 80 years to find the lowland gorilla and prove its existence, mm-hmm. from a group of people who swore up and down for generations, this thing's here. We've mm-hmm. shared the woods with it. So we are not up against that 80-year window with Sasquatch. We are not up against that 80-year window with UFOs, UAPs from 1947. You know? So we're just burgeoning on it. So the fact that science is just now taking the deep dive interest that it's taking, that NASA is finally forming panels on this topic, things like that. That's what closes that gap in 10 to 15 mm-hmm. years, Bob, is the high scientific interest that we have now. Before, we've had cursory scientific interest. People who were amazing, you know, nuclear scientists, all kinds of things involved with the projects. But we now have a vastly larger grouping of scientists that are interested in it. So the data is going to come windfall at this point.
Right. And the technology is there to interpret it.
Exactly.
Whereas 80 years ago, we didn't have that. Or did we? I'm a big into time travel. So it makes you wonder. Just made me remember something. I was watching yesterday on a treadmill at the gym on Roku TV.
Roku, yeah.
A 1952 science fiction show called Tales of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear of it?
Absolutely.
And it was an episode about a military base where a triangle craft lands, and it's got hieroglyphics on the outside of it.
Oh, my God.
What does that remind you of? It's Rendlesham, 1980.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And the question is, are we in a simulation? How could they possibly, show you on a TV screen in black and white a perfect triangle in a hangar with hieroglyphics on it, and then 27 years later or whatever, you have the Rendlesham incident, which is essentially the same thing?
Yeah, yeah. And it's fascinating, especially whenever you go – I listen to a lot of old-school sci-fi radio shows whenever I go on the road to go to sleep. Mm-hmm. It drives my wife crazy at home, so I don't do that at home. But at night on the road, I listen to two or three just sitting in the bed in the dark, laying down. And one of them that I listen to pretty regularly actually had an episode – where they were talking about writing information on atoms. They'd basically turned the world over to an AI that answered all the questions in the universe for them. So they would pose it, it would give them the answer, and all the data was written on atoms. And it's like, in 1938, they are talking about quantum computing.
Right. Quantum computing, right.
So these concepts, these ideas have been out there and floating around for a long time, Bob. And yes, some of the question does come to bear. Where does the inspiration come from?
Right.
Even at that projected timeline, it's fascinating to think that somebody at that point was considering these things scientifically.
Right.
Well, because much like any good television show like Star Trek, things like that, they have consultants. They have people that come to them with vast technologies and like, these are some of the things that we've hypothesized for space travel, stuff like that. So the hypothesis of these things and the ideas of where they come from are nothing really new. And when you're talking about especially experiencers and their cases, there was one you were telling me about and that I know I've seen you on a few shows recently talking about, the jellyfish case, not the jellyfish UFO object that of course was debunked by Mark D'Antonio, things like that, as a grouping of floating balloons, but more jellyfish entities that have been spotted interacting with people. So let's get into that a little bit.
So when the Corbell video came out, Mark D'Antonio and the MUFON photo analysis team basically came up with 11 points debunking what it was. And what I thought it could be was possibly a humanoid-shaped drone wearing a ghillie suit camouflage with the two propellers. All right, they couldn't be seen because of the mess. And it was just a surveillance humanoid-shaped drones, and you can find them on Amazon. They're like 5 feet tall, dressed in military fatigues with two propellers on the shoulder. And that seems to be the more logical answer. But as we searched the keyword search in the MUFON CMS, like I mentioned before, with the word jellyfish and squid, we started coming up with all sorts of stuff, and it wasn't outdoors, it was indoors. And this is where it gets really weird.
Yeah.
I had one newspaper article from the Singapore Times from 1937, where a very famous psychic, Zelma Brady Moore, I believe was her name, Bramley Moore, she was vacationing in Singapore, and in the middle of the night, she woke up to see this blue, luminous jellyfish. She said it was like a rugby ball on end, and it had one long tentacle coming down that was throbbing blue, and it had attached itself to her forehead. And when she awoke, it retreated, it jumped back, and she said that she felt like her life force had been being sucked out of her, and she probably would have died had she not awoken. And the thing just disappeared. So did it come in through a window? Singapore, it's hot, maybe. Or did it just dematerialize into another dimension? But we found in the MUFON CMS more cases. And two I'll tell you about right now was that back in 2016, on October 24th, a woman in Iran reported to us that she awoke and there was this blue and red jellyfish on her chest, and she felt like it was penetrating into her, and she knocked it off of her, and it dematerialized again. And she looked down, and she had what was like a surgical scar, and she took a picture of it, and she actually sent it to MUFON.
Wow.
So it's not a slit. It's actually, it looks like, you know, right after an operation for an appendicitis attack, all right? Almost as if it was an intentional penetration of her body. But here's where it gets weird. This was October 24th, 2016 in Iran. Less than 24 hours later, in Vancouver, Canada, woman wakes up, jellyfish is over her, it's attached to her back, and she feels like it's operating on her. Opposite sides of the world, less than 24 hours apart.
Wow.
The thing's attached to her, and she wakes up, it retreats, it's glowing blue. Like the other case, it's the tentacles, almost like the Christmas tree lights, glowing blue, retreats, disappears, and her period was heavy for months. She couldn't stop bleeding, you know, in the cycle for months. And she says, I felt that this object, this jellyfish, was doing something to my body. We have several more cases, but those are the three most fascinating ones, especially the two that happen within 24 hours of each other on opposite sides of the world.
Also kudos to MUFON for your website being able to be opened in Iran.
The fact that
the regime over there doesn't block y'all's website from people making reports is pretty impressive.
Oh, well, I will tell you, one report we got from Turkey, the person actually told us that they were afraid for their life because if the government found out that they were reporting UFOs, they're afraid that because it's an Islamic country, very strict, that they may be arrested or killed.
Yeah.
So I think that's why we get less reports from, you know, say, dictatorship regimes. Like, you know, China, we only get like 6 or 7 cases a year from China at most. And his entire book's in my library behind me, like UFOs over China. The book's this thick. So I know that there are historically a lot of reports from China.
Tons.
Yeah.
And that's just it. You know, that's something that bears to be brought up as well, Bob, is the cultural morals and mores of a society and how they've receive and view these things,
right?
You know, because I'm even talking with Edward Mong a couple weeks ago about his experience and I was like, did you tell anybody? He was like, no, this was, you know, Puerto Rico in the 1990s. Like, I'd have been thrown into an asylum if I told anybody that this happened to me in my bedroom. You know, and even here in the United States, it's just become, and I'm not going to say in vogue or in fad to have had an experience, but it's just become much more commonplace for people to be willing to share and not reticent to share their experience, Bob.
Yeah. And it's like when you go back into early Islamic culture or the jinn. Actually, entities, right?
Yeah.
But one of the bad things about different cultures being afraid to report things, or cultures like the United States where everybody wants to report something, there's a twofold problem going on right now. Is that one, we're not getting accurate statistics because we really don't know how many reports are coming out of China. Okay, so you can't say that there's been a rise in UFO reports in 2025 compared to 2024 because we will never know. The other problem is that more and more organizations like Arrow, Enigma, New Fork, MUFON, it's busting up where all the reports go. So you don't know how many reports Enigma gets or Arrow really gets. So you're never going to have accurate statistics anymore about flaps, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, especially whenever it comes to how that data is shared Bob, how that data is culled, how that data is put together. It's really hard because sadly, and this is something that I've spoken about regularly at conferences that I've been talking at lately, is it reminds me a lot of college and my friends that were in like biochemistry, things like that, and going for like, vying for a summer at Chapel Hill to go to their DNA department, things like that. And they would literally sabotage each other's experiments. Mm-hmm. All kinds of horrible things happened, you know? And it's like, this is kind of a really horrible looking under the skin of science, because yes, there is quite a bit of that happens. There is quite mm-hmm. a bit of, poo-pooing other people's information, putting other right. things down. And that, I don't know. I don't find that necessarily helps the scientific community, and labs do that with each other. It's fascinating to see, and also kind of horrifying to see, because at the same time, it's like, how do we get forward in science?
Right.
Right. If everybody is just kind of towing a line, so to speak, you know?
If you go back historically, like in the Project Aquarius Library, I don't want to keep bringing it up, but we have the correspondences between Walt Andrus of MUFON when he broke away from Arrow and created the Midwest UFO Network, and correspondences with Kufos going back and forth.
Sure.
Back 50 years ago, they wanted to get together, and they ended up sabotaging each other rather than cooperating.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of them are gone right now. It's very, very sad. You know, it's lamentable.
Well, and it's kind of that way. I see it, and not just in ufology, my friend. I see it in cryptozoology. I see it in paranormal research, all kinds of things where people are very, very guarded mm-hmm. with their data. And mm-hmm. and yes, I understand, because there is some reticence to share data because of the sabotage that can happen. But at the same mm-hmm. token, it's one of those, how do we get to a point of building those bridges? You know, mm-hmm. because we've got to get there before science gets to us. We as communities mm-hmm. have to get there. And it's important for us to do that. So it's interesting to me to see, because even once again, you guys – number one, I will say this about MUFON all day long, everybody. They have had the most contiguous intake mm-hmm. and contiguous intake form of data more than anybody else for the longest time. And it the amount of data that you guys have is vast and large, Bob. It's amazing. It's great. And, you know, even the fact that on your report a UFO, and I'll bring it up on screen so people can see, it actively starts with, if you have seen this, do not make a report. Like you, you actively start culling the data before you even take a report. And I love that. I love the idea that like, no, if you've seen this, this is a regular occurring phenomena. This is something in the sky. You may not be, you may not be aware of it or aware of what it looks like, but here it is. And that's there before you ever give your report. So it basically keeps 1,000 reports probably every month or so from coming in from SpaceX launches, things like that.
We still get lots of SpaceX.
Absolutely. I saw a jellyfish in the sky. Well, mm-hmm. you know, you probably saw a booster separation is what you saw.
But when you see the spiral,
yeah.
that's the rocket shooting off. It's right there. All right. People think that's a portal. We get that all the time, that it's an interdimensional portal. And they swear that something's coming out of it and nothing's coming out of it.
Yeah.
Same thing with the blue orbs. They're internal lens reflections of the sun. And the reason why it's a blue orb is because camera lenses are coated with sapphire dust to cut down on reflections. So
that's right.
That we get a lot of that. The thing also about MUFON is that we investigate and we make our data available to the public. If the public goes to MUFON.com, you can just click on latest 20 cases and see a short summary of what the witness reported, plus whatever photo or video they submitted. If you're an actual member, you actually get access to the case management system search capability, where you can do keyword searches, date searches, craft type, was there an entity involved, all sorts of things. Arrow's not going to give you that. All right. Every article 3 years in on Arrow, they've investigated over 700 reports. I bet they've investigated a lot more than 700 at this point. Right. But the news media keeps talking 700 3 years in a row. So what do they have and why don't they give it to the public? And why would you be crazy enough to report it to them? Because you're never going to get an answer. At least we try.
Yeah. And I will say this. I will say this about Arrow. And the one thing, because I can find something I can like about just about anybody, Bob. however, I will say they have finally brought reporting a UFO for somebody behind a flight stick. They finally made it okay. Where you're not going to lose your job as a Delta pilot. If you come forward and make a report, you aren't going to lose your job and your 20 years behind the flight stick as a Navy pilot. If you come forward and report. So let's give them that. At least they have made a unified means of reporting, because before, much like, the UFO and ufology field to begin with, you had Norfolk, you had, you know, MUFON, you had Afro. Numerous. Avro, right. You had numerous agencies that take things in. Are they taking all the same data in, is the question. Is it a unified way of reporting?
Right.
And at least amongst these now alphabet agencies, there is a unified means of reporting and for taking in that scientific data and a no shame way to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, so that I think is a huge, huge step forward. With things.
And MUFON does submit quarterly reports.
Oh, absolutely.
To Congress. Kirsten Gillibrand gets reports from us. Tim Burchett, Andre Carson, Nancy Mace. All right.
Yeah.
We send reports to them on a quarterly basis. We don't deal with the military, but we do deal with the People's Congress.
That's right.
At this point.
That's right. And you know, those are the important steps, much like we say about targeted individuals and targeting technology. Sadly, Bob, that stuff is only going to happen through an act of Congress. That stuff is only going to happen. And will we see through these hearings that are happening? We will not see wreckage rolled out onto the floor of Congress. We won't. I've said that before on the show. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to see an aha moment where somebody comes out with a tube and a sheet and is like, ha ha, here's the body. But what we will see is an Ollie North raising his hand, taking an oath and saying, yes, we have been hiding this. Yes, this has been happening. We will see a fall guy come from it. Yeah, guaranteed. Whether it's an alphabet agency or a contractor thereof, you will see that happen through all these things. Because yes, Grush has told us that when he came to the places where the money led, the door was slammed in his face. Mm-hmm. You know, so we know that there's money. We know that there's a paper trail. We know that there's a money trail. I mean, even in the last hearing, they were like, so confirmed there are no retrieval programs. That's correct. Well, what about this person who's being paid because they were injured in a retrieval program? Well, you should really look into that. Because we can't talk about the retrieval program, but we can firmly give somebody help and assistance medically after they've been injured in a crash retrieval program.
Yeah, well, they didn't give assistance to Cash and Landrum when they were exposed, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we did see the disclosure of Area 51 through very much the same means. It was only because of those poor people downwind of burning stealth materials that a federal lawsuit was filed and Bill Clinton had to go, yeah, Area 51's real. Sorry about that. So, yes, these are the means by which we get to the truth. sadly. And I'm not saying that we don't have things locked away at WrightPad. I'm not saying that we don't have recovered technology. I'm a firm believer that we do, and that it is in the hands of contractors.
I will tell you that MUFON has possession of three pieces of anomalous material, and we'll be presenting it again at the MUFON Symposium, James and I, on July 18th or 19th, this Saturday. One of them is the Russian sample that we had last year that has proven to be a very, very anomalous piece of material.
Yeah.
The way it was manufactured, what it's manufactured out of, and proof that it was in space at one point. There's also some other information coming out about testing of additional Roswell material.
Exactly.
And a piece of metal that allegedly fell off a triangle that was actually tested by the NSA and was at one point, I believe, in Lou Elizondo's possession, and now we have it for testing.
Wow.
They might not, pull the sheet off the big craft, but if you just got something this big and, it's not
that's
from
just it.
Anywhere we can figure out, we got something.
That's it. That's it. Exactly. Exactly. And it's through those means, it's through good people like Grush and stuff like that coming forward that we get these hearings and that we get to the bottom of this stuff. So, I hold nothing but hope for the next 5 to 10 years of the field of ufology and what we will come to both scientifically and legally as far as disclosure goes, Bob.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you this, disclosure might come in the weirdest way because there is a financial institution called Tuttle is the name of it. And they're going to be offering an ETF called UFOD. And I have nothing to do with them. This isn't a push for them, but they're going to invest an ETF in companies that they believe may be back engineering UFO debris. So the money continues to grow. All right. This is a big time ufology for big money. So let's see where that goes. Yeah, the Tuttle Group, I think it's called UFOD ETF.
Huh.
They've applied to put out. Imagine investing in companies that may be reverse engineering UFO material.
Yeah. Yeah, no, precisely. And there it is right there from NASDAQ. Tuttle Capital files for ETF tied to UFO related technologies. That is really and listed on NASDAQ. So it's
something's coming.
Something definitely big is coming.
That's not a waste of money. That's not a waste of money if you're doing that.
Exactly. And those are the exciting things that you can really that make things tangible, Bob. Mm-hmm. That let you know that something is really coming down the pipeline. Mm-hmm. When they are releasing things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. I want to thank you for your time as always. It was great catching up pre-show and, we need to keep in touch more. I always love our conversations. It's great. I am looking forward to the symposium this year. It's going mm-hmm. to be awesome. I look forward to seeing you there. Let everybody know where they can go to join MUFON, find out more about MUFON, where they can go to get involved and find out more about the symposium, Bob.
Sure. Two websites. If you see a UFO or if you've been abducted, go to MUFON.com, MUFON.com. Up there in the upper right-hand corner, you can report a UFO or report an abduction experience. The symposium, simply go to MUFONsymposium.com. The symposium is going to be July 17th through the 20th in Cincinnati. And we actually have Gary Nolan. Will be there speaking, and we'll be having Thomas Jane speaking. So, buckle up, Betty. It's going to be quite a show. And to join MUFON, you can join as inexpensively as $6 a month, and you get an electronic version of our MUFON Journal magazine, very beautifully done.
Yep.
You can get a an additional membership MUFON TV with over 800 original programs, and it's just a great organization to belong to. So that's it, MUFON.com and MUFONSymposium.com. And Chris, thank you very, very much. I always appreciate talking to you. I hope I see you in July.
Same.
And we'll do it again.
Absolutely. I guarantee you we'll have you on again before the show, everything else, Bob. Thank you so much for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from MUFON as well as the MUFON Symposium over at MUFONSymposium.com, folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share. That's where you can comment on videos. That's where you can find the video channel that we have, curiousrealm.com/videos, and you can follow all of the YouTube channels of our guests as well as see our exclusive coverage from events like MUFON Symposium that we have sponsored and gone to the last many years. You can also visit curiousrealm.com/store and get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a investigator in the world of UFOs, ufology, if you are an investigator in cryptozoology or paranormal, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your back pocket data log to write down all of your experience data as it happens in the field so that you are ready to shake hands with science come the day that your data needs to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, as always, for your time tonight. Thank you for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.